It seemed that while I followed rutted trails to a very uncertain fortune, Billy and Long were rapidly outpacing me up the financial ladder. While Billy was chasing coyotes, playing poker, no doubt adding to his wallet, I just kept chugging along, determined that hard work would see me through. A month before the interest on my note was due, I paid a visit home to spend a few days with my family. I tried to let on like all was well, but Bobby pried my worries out of me. She suggested I borrow the money from Long, as he was our friend, and we could have him paid back by midwinter if I kept the road hot. Long would have loaned us the money, but he was gone to the Creek Nation delivering his first government contracts, and besides, he was bound to be strapped from the investment in his farming operation, or so I told her. It wasn't right of us to lay our troubles off on him every time he turned around. Ashamed as I am to say it, it bugged me at the time that a black man was doing far better than me. Well, it took 2 days for me to settle the matter with her, or at least I thought I did. She'd wanted to visit her father in Clarendon for a good while, and I had a load going that way. I would take her with me and leave her to visit there while I worked to make the loan payment. It was gonna take a Herculean effort to make enough money by the payment deadline, but I assured her I would get it done. I felt not one bit of the confidence in myself that I showed her. My troubles left me for the trip to Clarendon, and I enjoyed the camping along the trail with my wife and boy. My son was growing like a weed and already tottering about on his hind legs and getting into everything he wasn't supposed to. He had his mother's green eyes, and he reminded me of her when he smiled. I left Bobby and Owen with Mr. Allen, grateful that I had good excuse not to tarry too long. Father and daughter seemed to have patched up any rift our marriage had caused, but he and I didn't see eye to eye on anything. He promised to send my family by stage to meet me in Mobidi 1 month from the day I left him. I headed for that same town to pick up a load of telegraph poles. I was to drop them off at intervals along a stretch of the government trail north of the stage stop on the Canadian. My plan was to drop off the last of the poles and herd down to a place east along the Canadian within the Cheyenne Reservation, where I knew of a stand of unusually big cedar. I'd cut a wagon load of posts and deliver him back to sell to the soldiers at Fort Elliott in time to meet Bobby there as she arrived by stage. With pay for my 2 freight trips and money from the sale of the cedar post the government was buying, I should have enough to pay my loan. As I traveled, I tried not to remind myself of the good chance that what I was doing probably wouldn't work. I made short work of dropping off my telegraph poles, and I cut a beeline for the stand of cedar I had located. Neither the Cheyenne nor government troops on patrol caught me cutting reservation trees. It took me 2 weeks with an axe to do what a man who knew how to use one could have done in one. By the end of that time, I was headed back to Mobidi with a wagon load of posts to sell and hands covered in bloody blisters. Well, if nothing else, a trip had taught me that a cowboy's hands don't fit an axe handle. Triumphantly, I made town the night before Bobby arrived and was waiting for her when she stepped down off the stage with Owen on her arm. I hugged both of them and quickly told them of my success. Owen was tired from his trip on the stage, and I rented a room for him with what I could scrape from my pocket. While she lay Owen down for a nap, I hitched my team and went up to the fort to sell my posts. It nearly took the entire U.S. Army to get me out of there.
We aren't buying pickets of posts anymore.
That smug lieutenant stood under the shaded porch of the quartermaster's building and eyed my loaded wagon.
You told me a month ago you were.
That was a month ago.
I was counting on you buying posts.
You've obviously miscalculated. You had no contract with us that I'm aware of, and I would suggest you try to find another buyer.
Well, you can shove these posts up your ass.
Mister, I am sorry for your tough luck. You do look like you could use some help.
He held up his hands in a gesture that was supposed to make him appear helpless. I helped him understand what helpless really felt like. The first sergeant came running around the corner of the building. Now that was back in the day when you had to be able to whoop every soldier on the line to make that rank, and from the size of him, I knew what I was in for. He was as tall as me, but twice as wide, with meat hook hands and shoulders like a miner. The long points of his waxed handlebar mustache twitched while he studied his fallen officer.
Your lieutenant made a little miscalculation and looks like he could use some help.
I rolled the unconscious man off the porch with my foot, and that sergeant ducked his bald head like a bull and charged at me. We both went down. His fist struck me in a barrage of blunt pain and splitting skin. Then he stood and gave my ribs a workout.
You had enough?
Oh, I reckon we're about even.
The sergeant dragged me over to my wagon and left me there. By and by, I climbed up a wheel and pulled myself into the seat. Thoroughly routed by the army, I made my way down the road. I didn't want to face Bobby with the news just yet, and I was too stubborn to just give up and quit. I loitered around town for a while, trying to figure out what to do. My swollen, battered features drawing curious stares from every single person I passed. Late in the afternoon, I managed to trade the load of posts to the firm of Ride and Wrath for the mule I owed them for. They wanted me to deliver them to the fort. And I just smiled like that was the best news I'd ever heard, and I waited for him to go back inside. Then I proceeded to pitch every last one of those damn posts out on the ground in their wagon yard.
There! Yes.
Well, that lifted my spirits a little bit, so I was over my mad some when I found Bobby talking to Billy on the porch of old Laughlin's.
Whoa, you look like you woke up in an alley.
What happened?
Just a little business disagreement.
I put one arm around the waist.
Well, I hope the other fella looks worse.
For the life of me, I can't understand you men.
A bath, a barber, and a trip to the mercantile will have him good as new.
Clothes cost money, and I guess Bobby read the look on my face because she immediately knew that something was wrong.
They didn't buy your posts?
All I could do was nod because nothing I could say would make the way things were sound any better. I had two little bank drafts for freight deliveries in my pocket, but they didn't amount to anywhere near what we needed.
I can loan you the money. You can pay me back when you got it.
Part of me almost wilted with relief. But the other part stiffened when I realized that Bobby had told him of our tight finances.
Thanks, but I don't need charity.
It ain't charity. That's what friends are for.
Thanks, but...
But nothing! You've loaned me money before.
That didn't ever amount to a dollar or two or a drink at night's end. If you really want to lend a hand, you can ride with me back up to the post and help me whip those soldier boys.
Take the money.
All right. But I'll pay you back Christmas for sure.
You'll be a cattle baron by then.
Yeah, thanks. I owe you.
I shook his hand. I soon had a hot bath, a spotty shave, and a haircut. I sported a brand new outfit from my boots to the new beaver hat sitting on my head, and I was carrying enough money in my pocket to cover the bank payment plus a little extra, all at Billy's expense. I wasn't fool enough not to know how lucky I was to have a friend like him. Bobby wanted to retire to our room early for the trip home the next day, and she didn't put up any fuss when Billy drugged me off for a drink or two before I called it an evening. We had just barely ordered a drink when Billy waved to a gent in the back of the room with mutton chop whiskers and a big pipe dangling from the corner of his mouth. He was playing poker with a full table, and a couple of girls flirted about his head. I assumed he must be no other than Archie, and Billy led me over.
Archie, this here's Nate. He's the man I was telling you about.
I looked down to see I'd almost stepped on the enormous pair of dogs lying at the Englishman's feet. They were raw-boned, grizzled animals with long legs and thick, matted coats of shaggy hair. They looked at me with wild, yellow, ancient eyes, and I knew they were killers just the same as I'd seen men who struck me as such.
I see you admire my wolfhounds.
I'm glad I ain't a coyote.
Are you a pugilist, Mr. Reynolds? I do so like to exercise with a bit of boxing from time to time.
Not so you'd notice.
Are you a sporting man?
I'd already decided I did not like him, but I shook my head no. He was the kind who asked questions just to hear himself talk.
Too bad. I find the Texas game a tad boring at times, and I would like to find someone other than Billy who can test my skill.
Apparently, Billy was the only one of his employees with enough cash or enough balls to not let the pompous SOB buy every pot.
Come on, Nate. There's two open seats.
I'll just have a drink and watch.
The whiskey burned the cuts in my mouth and on my swollen lips, but it hit bottom with a pleasing warmth that I found myself in the mood for. I watched the game long enough to see that despite my observations, the English Duke could play a little. Nobody at that table was in either his or Billy's league. As the night progressed, the Cowboys slowly left the game to be replaced by a few of Mo Beattie's gamblers looking for all the action they could find. I found myself at the bar with a couple of the boys I knew and passed the time visiting with them and slowly, steadily getting drunker than I had planned. Billy was on a hot streak, and he was stacking money before him like bricks. I continued to drink, and the more I watched him win, the more I got to thinking about money. And the more I thought about money, the more I thought about having to take money from him in front of my wife. By the time Billy was 500 ahead, I was drunk enough to feel sorry for myself and mean enough to blame him for his good fortune. Well, they say there aren't any answers to be found in a bottle, but an idea so easy that it made awful sense came very clearly to my slurred brain. Vengeance and redemption lay within my reach, and I felt no shame or remorse for what I decided to do. Without a word to Billy, I left the saloon. I rode Dunny out of town, headed north at a high lope for the Horseshoe Ranch. I had a bottle in my hand and another in my saddlebags to see to it that I didn't falter or fail in what I set out to do. I woke B. Hopkins, the ranch boss, in the middle of the night, and I drug him from his bed, and I sold him that horse. By late morning, I was back in Mo Beattie on another lathered horse, except it wasn't Dunny I rode. I came through the door to my room, blind, drunk, and crazy.
It's me, Bobby.
I wave the wad of bills in my hand before her eyes like a madman.
Where did you get that?
Bobby's eyes darted to a valise where I'd put Billy's money that evening before. Before she could search the bag, I was across the room and I jerked it from her hands and sailed it against the wall.
We don't need his money. I got $1,000 in my hand right here.
You're drunk.
Maybe, but I got money.
Where did you get it?
I sprawled into the chair by the door.
What have you done, Nathan?
I couldn't bring myself to say it.
Tell me what you've done.
I sold Dunny. I sold him. And I'm glad I did it.
I held out the money and I begged her with the sight of it to ignore how I had spited my friend and tried to buy her love. I woke up that evening alone, with the money still clutched in my wretched, jealous hand. Even the long, cold winter that followed wasn't enough punishment to absolve me of my guilt and torment. As one blizzard after another swept down upon the high plains, the bitterness inside me refused to leave, and instead, it seemed frozen inside of me. Every day that I saw my good horse gone, I promised myself to be a better man. But the simple sanity of such good intentions eluded me, and I felt not one bit different. I told myself 1,000 times I must be crazy, and I cursed myself for the weakness that would eventually drive my family from me. My jealousy had caused a festering sore between Bobby and I, and my petty, spiteful actions would pick at it until she could bear me no more. You would think that a man so blessed with a beautiful wife and child as I was would be at ease with the turning of the earth, but I seemed determined to destroy what I held so dear. If life has taught me anything, it's that the entire human race is as crazy as a shithouse rat, and only through denial and false pretense does it appear otherwise. Hidden from the cold behind the icy collar of my buffalo coat, I rode the frozen prairie daily, wondering if it was Billy that my wife loved and ashamed of such thinking. I followed the long drift of the cattle southward in a vain attempt to see that my meager herd survived the brutal cold. Visibility was getting worse as the wind whipped up snow on the ground to mix with the fresh snowflakes starting to fall from the sky, and I could just make out the forms of a group of riders headed my way. I could tell by the way they sat their saddles that they'd been out in the elements as long as I had. They came on with chins tucked down inside their coats and their horses carrying their heads slanted away from the bite of the crosswind. It was a hard group of men who faced me with weary, sunken eyes, measuring the world with no nonsense at all. The clench of their haggard, unshaken jaws was made even harder by the cold. There were 5 of them, and 3 of them rode rocking chair horses. Billy and Andy were among them, and I thought it strange that they should be north of the fence when their range lay south of the river. It was the first time I'd faced Billy since I'd sold Dunny, and I uneasily sought to decipher if he knew what I'd done. Well, if he knew, he didn't show it or bring the matter up.
You ready to cut the wire?
I am.
The association has ordered riders out to keep anybody from cutting their fence and letting the trip through. But only a few old diehards are gonna weather this storm when they could be sitting in a bunkhouse tending the fire. Rocking chair cattle don't travel against the wind. But a few good men in the north have offered a bounty should any man be brave enough to cut this fence.
Why don't they do it themselves?
One of them and two of his hands tried a week ago west of here. They got turned back at the point of a fence patrol's guns.
They have to shoot me if they catch me, because I ain't watching my cattle die against that fence.
Let's set things right.
Billy pitched a loop upon a fence post. The wood of the fence succumbed to the pull, and a long section of barbed wire fell to the ground. While the others cut wire with axes and pliers, with my saddle horn and my horse's strong back, I merrily joined the destruction. Maddened by our success, we split up in two groups to open up other sections of fence before the blizzard drove us to shelter. I rode east with Billy and Andy, thinking the most of my cattle would hit the fence in that direction. By the time we'd finished our third hole, I could barely see Andy standing 20 feet from me.
Let them eat the brakes of the river clean. The association be damned.
We watched the cattle already pawing through and knew that if the weather continued, the drift might come from as far as Nebraska by winter's end. We drug some sections of fence entirely away, while others we had just pulled down to let the cattle walk over. Billy led us through one of those openings we just managed to lay over. Billy's horse viciously kicked out a hind leg, snagged in the wire. I was sure I saw that horse go to the ground, but my own horse was shying under me at the excitement. Billy was pinned down under his thrashing, crazed horse. Before I could take any action, wire snapped and gave, and Billy's horse lunged to its feet in a run, with Billy dragging the ground wildly, one boot hung in the stirrup. I managed to get beside Billy's runaway horse, my hands latched onto the bridle. It was all I could do to hang on, and my efforts to stop the horse only seemed to make him run faster. With one hand over the far side of the horse's neck and holding the bridle cheek piece, I risked falling away by reaching to grab the shank of his bit on the near side with my other hand. I tugged with all my might, succeeding in jerking the crazed animal's head around and sending us crashing end over end to the ground. The fall must have broken the horse's neck because he lay still next to me. I looked around furiously for Billy, but found only his empty boot lodged against the top of his stirrup. Billy's body was a lump in the snow that I crashed over as I ran blindly back along the way we came.
Billy! Oh, you hurt bad.
I didn't know the country well enough to get him to help, and my horse was surely still traveling fast in the direction he was going when I left him. But there are such things as miracles, and Billy shoved off my hands and sat up by his own power.
I'm just skinned up some.
Andy couldn't find his butt with both hands in the dark, but he rode 100 yards in a blinding blizzard right to where we were.
Can you ride?
I'm all right. My leg's a little stiff, but I think nothing's broke.
Andy dismounted, and we shoved Billy in the saddle. I motioned for Andy to climb up behind him.
Is your mind steady enough to remember where you were taking us?
Billy merely nodded and kicked the horse forward, while I grabbed a hold of the passing tail and drug along wearily behind. I don't know how long we traveled because I was so damn cold and tired that minutes may have seemed like hours. We started over the lip of a steep grade, took a dozen more steps, and then I made out the shape of a small dugout. We quickly retreated into the shelter. Billy and Andy fought the wind to get the door closed. Long after Andy had a fire going, I lay on the floor, wanting nothing more than the comfort of a long, deep sleep. Unsure how long we would be trapped, we fed the fire stingily and huddled close to its feeble warmth. The storm lasted the night and into the next morning. Our fire, started with a pack rat's nest, soon ate up the wood of what little broken-down furnishings the dugout possessed. When the wind no longer howled over the dugout, Andy rose and opened the door, looking out at the frigid aftermath that was the new morning. From where I sat at the fire, I could see between Andy's knees the frozen corpse of his horse lying just outside the door.
There's no snow falling. The wind has just about quit. You saved my life back there. I thought I was a goner for sure.
You'd done the same for me.
Uh-huh. But I thank you just the same.
That's what friends are for.
I looked at Billy and knew he was about the best friend I'd ever had. And at the same time, I came to the realization that I had to take Bobby away from the country where he lived if I were to ever know any peace.
I won't forget.
And neither could I, no matter how hard I tried. Well, my second son was born that winter, and we named him Samuel Houston Reynolds, a fine Texas name if ever there was one. To all appearances, he seemed a healthy baby boy. But by the time he was 2 weeks old, a fever and a cough racked his little body. With his condition rapidly worsening, we raced him to Mobile in the middle of the night. The doctor there helped us to save him, but he was as weak and fragile as fall leaves before the wind. We were too afraid to get far from the doctor, and I rented us a little house above the Sweetwater for the time being. The child's convalescence drug out longer than I'd planned, and spring came with little improvement in his lungs. The winter had cost me too many cattle, and the hot, dry summer that followed just about finished off my hopes of building a herd. I'd never liked bouncing along on the seat of a freight wagon, cussing at a team of mules for my living. And the fear of returning home from one of my long trips to find Samuel dead kept me home so long that we were soon scraping the bottom of the money barrel. I was loafing in the Pink Pussycat Saloon when a chance at a new occupation called on me. Cap Arrington walked up to me and plainly and simply asked me to go to work as his deputy for no other reason than he thought I'd performed well in our apprehension of those two bandits a couple of years before. I'd always scoffed at the law, but the thought at least merited consideration. I guess I drove a hard bargain because he offered me $60 a month, half to be paid by the association, and 5% of his cut of fees, fines, etc. I'd never wanted to be a lawman, but to me, anything beat hauling freight. I was ready to start my new profession. Like me, Cap may have been receiving bonus pay from the association, but I found him a fair man, even if a little bullheaded in his sense of justice. I didn't consider myself a tough man, and I was content to follow his lead and learn the trade. Despite Bobby's worries, I didn't get shot those first couple of months. And in fact, did nothing much that could even be considered dangerous. Most of the time, Cap seemed content to keep me as his presence around Mobile while he rode the countryside sniffing out cattle rustlers and horse thieves. Other than lending the city marshal a hand and quieting some drunk, I stood a little chance of being shot, except on those occasions when Cap got a lead on the whereabouts of some wanted men and called me out to help in the chase. Well, most of those leads didn't pan out, and my education into handling desperados was slow, to say the least. Long about August, Cap got me out of bed in the middle of the night. I followed him out a ways into the sandhills in my bare feet and drawers and found a posse holding four horses in the dark.
How long since you've seen Billy?
I haven't seen him more than a month. Arch's crew's been around, but Billy hasn't made the rounds here for a while.
You know he killed Colonel Andrews a week ago over in Tascosa?
I merely nodded that I knew, and I let it go at that. The Cowboy Rumor Express was faster than the telegraph at times, and I'd gotten the details secondhand not 3 days after it had happened.
You don't want him for that, do you?
No, the officials over that way ruled it self-defense. And I dare say I envy Billy some. I would have liked to have caught that man myself. The grand jury down at Clarendon has indicted Billy and your other friend Andy on charges of cattle theft.
Oh, Billy's no rustler.
We got word from a stock detective that he is.
Well, what detective?
Dale Martin.
Hell, that school teacher's the worst stock thief in the entire country. And everybody knows it.
I guess he reformed. The association puts a lot of faith in his work.
I'll agree he's caught a few rustlers, but that was probably just to cover up his own thieving.
You don't have to come with us. In fact, it'd probably be best if you didn't.
Best thing you can do is just send word for Billy to come turn himself in. Give him some time to get over the urge to fight, and he'll show up soon enough to call us all liars.
No, I got an idea where he and Andy are, and I'm going to have him in Clarendon for the coming session of court in Donnelly County.
I don't blame you if you fire me, but I won't have any part of this.
I figured you wouldn't go, and I can't say as I don't respect you for it. I just hope he's worth your trouble.
I know him better than most.
I know more than enough to judge that I might have to shoot him to bring him in.
He won't fight you if you give him some time to think it over.
Like I said, I know him better than you think. I trust you well enough that you won't try and warn him.
I walked back to the house with a bad feeling in my bones. Billy was hell on wheels with a pistol in his hand and his color up. The Cap didn't take any chances. If he wanted you, he'd wait an ambush with leveled rifles. And if you decided to make a fight of it, you'd end up riding home tied belly down on your saddle. Cap Arrington and his posse beat the sagebrush for a week in search of Billy and Andy, but they didn't get so much as a whiff of their scent. One fine, bright Sunday morning at the end of that same week, I was walking with Bobby and the children upon the sandy path to church. I should have been shocked when I spotted no other than Billy himself enter the Lady Gay Saloon, but on the other hand, I should have expected no less audacity from the man. Before I'd taken two more steps, I saw another thing that concerned me even more. Cap Arrington's gray horse was tethered in front of the courthouse, standing alongside several others that I was sure belonged to the rest of the posse. In my mind, there was nothing but one thing to do before Cap got wind that Billy was in town.
Be careful, Nathan. He's a proud man.
I know a little something about foolish pride.
I made my way to the saloon. The length of the room was between us. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw Andy sitting at a corner table with a Winchester hidden in his lap. Nothing much usually bothered Andy, but it was obvious he was fretting. I would have been nervous, too, had I been in his shoes with Billy calling the play.
Well, I never thought I'd see you wearing a badge.
Cap's coming. He's got 3 guns to back him.
I see him coming.
Billy gazed out over my shoulder through the saloon's front window.
Turn yourself in, and we'll prove it all a lie.
I'm more of a mind to show them that I'm tired of being picked at.
Arrington's got you outnumbered.
Then how do you figure in the count?
I won't let them shoot you down, if I can help it.
Andy rose and slipped along the wall to take a stand at the window just out of sight from the street. He was wiping sweaty hands on his shirt front, and his bottom lip was clenched in his teeth. Billy was standing just to the side of the door, watching Arrington make his way down the street. Billy noticed, just like I did, that two of the posse had disappeared, and he cast a quick look over his shoulder at the back entrance to the room.
Where do you stand, Nate? It's time to pay the fiddler. Throw down that badge, and we'll give old Cap a dose of humility.
He knew without me answering that I wasn't going to stand with him, and he turned his back on me to watch the street once more.
You better get home to your wife. It's fixing to get touchy in here.
In Billy's mind, he dismissed my presence, and his thoughts turned solely to the task at hand. I could see Cap and the deputy only 20 yards away and coming nearer. Watching Billy with his pistol hanging at the end of his arm, I knew that it was only seconds before he stepped into the doorway and opened up on the lawmen who thought they had him treed. My gun came to my hand, and I took two quick steps toward the door just as Billy turned halfway around to face me. The impact of my pistol barrel against his head shocked me to my elbow, and Billy folded up on the floor. I whirled to face Andy, who stood with his rifle leveled on my guts and a wild, shocked look on his face.
They would have killed him.
For a moment, I wasn't sure if Andy was going to shoot me or not, and tried everything I could to talk him down.
Drop your rifle, and we can beat this thing in court.
He was your friend, Tennessee.
That's why I did it.
Andy laid the Winchester upon a table and slumped limply into a nearby chair.
You better not have killed him.
As Cap entered the room, I held my gun on Billy, who was coming too.
They've both surrendered, Cap.
Cap's pale blue eyes studied Billy.
He ain't going to forgive you for that.
He didn't have to tell me the ramifications of what I'd done. I knew that from watching Billy's face as he managed, despite his throbbing head, to stand and prop himself against the door jamb. The look he gave me was as simple as it was murderous, and had he had a gun, he would have tried to kill me. His eyes left me and locked onto something across the street. There stood Barbie, holding Samuel in her arms, with Owen staring big-eyed from behind her skirt. Billy's lips formed a curse, and I knew that even if I'd had a chance of his accepting the buffalo and I'd just given him, he would never forgive me for Bobby and the kids seeing him that way. I studied Bobby where she stood and tried to interpret the look she was giving me for what it actually was. Maybe her perspective of the matter was closer to the truth, because I had no faith in my ability to find my way through the tangled mess that fate had woven for all of us.
That's all right, Cap. I don't sleep easy anyway.
That was the bitter truth. Neither Billy nor Andy ever threatened me while in jail or on the long ride to Clarendon, but neither acknowledged my presence with so much as a single word. I rode silent sentinel on the edges of their escort. Once or twice I caught Billy looking at me, and his stare was a cold, hard thing. I cursed him for a pig-headed fool who couldn't tell friend from foe. When the trial date came, I thought Billy would tell the entire court what he thought about them. But he never even said anything, other than to quietly answer the questions asked of him as he took his turn on the stand. He denied everything they accused him of, but he might have been yelling into a well for all the good it did him. It looked as if Billy and Andy were bound for a long stay in jail or high bond and years of lawyer's fees. There was no denying that I'd brought him to that point. But through legal shenanigans that only lawyers can understand, a deal was negotiated whereby Billy and Andy agreed to leave Texas if the state would drop all charges. It was a bitter pill to swallow, but they had no other options with so much set against them. Sometime during the night, they rode off bound for parts elsewhere, and the court said hallelujahs that justice held sway in the panhandle. That next morning, I handed Cap my badge and told him I was done with enforcing the law. He knew that I wasn't cut out for it anyhow, and he gave me no argument as I went upon my way. I stopped in Mobile long enough to hitch my team of mules to the wagon and load up the wife and the kids. We made our way to the home place and settled back into life away from town and badges and crooked cords. Despite drought, blizzard, and uncertain market, I talked long into partnering with me. We bought out a rancher I knew who wanted to recoup a little of the fortune he'd lost. We made the deal at a bargain price with the market panic going on. And though the few brands on his book didn't amount to much in numbers, I felt once again on my way to building the ranch I'd hoped for. We had another addition to the family when Fawn gave Long a pretty baby daughter. And about the same time, Bobby informed me that she was pregnant again. With the population of our little settlement booming, I couldn't help but wonder what the country was going to be like by the time all our children were grown. I helped Long put in a quarter section of wheat along the creek, although I couldn't see myself farming no matter how Long preached about the future in it. I was content to work our cattle or build improvements on the ranch. In between the toil and labor, I found time to spend with my family in those little moments that don't seem to matter much while they're happening. On hot summer days at dinner time, we would often take a picnic on the banks of the creek, where I swam under the hot sun with Owen riding on my back while Bobby watched with happy eyes. Sometimes in the evening, after Bobby had read or sung the kids to sleep, we would walk out across the prairie under the night sky, hand in hand like two young sweethearts. I came to know beyond all doubts that she loved me, and if possible, I loved her more. Those were good times, and to all intent and purpose, I looked as if I'd found peace away from the worries of the world. But in the back of my mind was the constant certainty that Billy would come calling one day when I least expected it. More than one person had heard him threaten to kill me in the years since the trial. When on that day I saw Cap Arrington loping his horse to me across the plains, I knew just about what he had come to tell me when he was still a mile away. From the sweat and dust caked on his tired mount, I took it that he'd come a long ways to see me, and fast.
You craving some of Bobby's biscuits? Or did you just miss me?
No, I've come on another matter altogether.
Get down and visit a while.
No, thanks.
Cap continued surveying my homestead, starting close to the house and working his gaze all the way to the horizon.
You come all the way from Mobile just to sit your horse in my yard?
Don't suppose you've seen Billy, have you?
No.
Well, he ain't in New Mexico, like everybody says.
You can't believe half of what you hear.
I rode into Mobile yesterday evening, and he just left there.
You think he's headed here?
That's a rumor.
I don't need you playing nursemaid to me.
There's some that say it was Billy that shot up that track-laying crew's locomotive east of Oneida last week.
Well, Billy never did like the thought of railroads coming here, nor farmers either. But I doubt he shot up a train, even if he was on a little Saturday night spree.
There are also those that say it was him that ran off with some of the Bar CC's horses last winter.
The Stock Association outlawed him. And that gives every gossip that wants to an excuse to lay every head of stolen association stock off on him.
You don't believe it?
He ain't the rustling kind.
But he's got it out for the association, don't he?
I wouldn't put it past him, pestering him a bit.
I've got some other bad news.
Yeah?
Andy was killed a little over a week ago. Some promoter hauled in an outlaw horse to Dodge and offered a $50 bounty to anybody who could ride him. They say the damn thing reared up and fell over on him.
I watched the wind roll the dust across the yard while I thought of Andy trying to ride a bad horse on a whim. He always claimed he could ride anything with hair, and I knew without being told he'd been laughing when he climbed into the saddle that one last time. The world had become a little tamer, when all the mad, vibrant life of him rushed out from his lungs, crushed between horse and ground. I missed him already.
Man never knows when his time is near.
Well, I'll be riding on. It's a long ride back to Mobidi.
Why are you so bound and determined to catch Billy?
I guess you could say he bothers me.
I watched until Cap was out of sight, and then I saddled my horse and got my Winchester. No silly premonition or casting of the bones led me down to wait for Billy at the creek crossing below the house. I knew he was coming for me just as I could tell when a rain was brewing, by watching black clouds building overhead. I felt no sense of doom, but I dreaded what I was sure would come. I was sitting on a cottonwood log when he rode into view just at dusk. As he wound his way down the slope to the crossing, I saw he wasn't alone. I couldn't make out the other rider in the failing light. My hand slipped back the hammer of my gun. My plan was to stop him on the far side of the crossing, and with the creek between us, we could say what needed said and settle what was between us. I was no match for him with a pistol, and a rifle fight in the growing dark was as good as I was likely to get. While I waited, I tried to determine just how things ended up like they were, and I'd come to no satisfactory conclusion when Billy rode down to the edge of the water and stopped.
That you, Nate?
Out of the dark shade of the cottonwoods, I stepped to the edge of the creek bank where the moonlight lit the water, and I cast a long shadow on its sheen. I stared across that universe of stars floating there at the vague shadow of Billy that could have been my twin for all appearances of the night. The other rider with him had stopped back in the brush, and I studied hard to see him there.
Hello, Billy.
I've come a long way to see you.
My rifle sprang to my shoulder, and I tensed myself with a bullet I was sure he had already sent on its way. I stared down the long glen of my worn rifle barrel, willing myself to hold steady, and knowing that I had already hesitated perhaps longer than I should have. Billy seemed as still as death, and I held on to the faint hope he would just ride away, leave things as they were.
Hold up there!
Billy raised his pistol quickly. It flamed twice, followed by a shotgun from somewhere down the creek. I watched as Billy reeled in the saddle. I waded the shallows to where he lay in the sand, already certain I would find him dead. He was on his back, with both eyes open to the sky above, and one hand upon his riddled chest. There was no sign of what force had left him lying peaceful there, for blood is not even so much as a shadow in the dark. I studied him there in his silent repose, and I knew he had nothing left to say to me forever and ever anymore. Cap came walking cautiously out of the dark with his shotgun leveled in his hands. I thought for a moment to shoot him down, but the urge was as short-lived as it was strong. I turned away from him and studied the place where I thought Billy's ally waited, and I was not quite sure that the night had seen all of its malicious intentions borne out yet. What possessed me to do what I did, I'll never know. But I walked toward what my eyes told me could be an enemy waiting in the brush, with my gun hanging useless at my side. When I neared to within no more than a few feet from the horse I could now make out standing there, I recognized an old friend. I wrapped my arms around Dunny's head and pressed his face against my chest.
I can't figure out why he let go of that extra horse. Unless he was going to swap a fresh one to run out of the country.
If Billy had killed me, he wouldn't have gone anywhere once it was done. Cap couldn't know that, but he was wrong just the same. He might be able to track an outlaw across the hardest rock, but he had no feel for the signs left by human nature and the awful tricks it played upon us all.
I'll go get my horse across the creek, and we'll take him on up to the house.
We placed Billy across my saddle. I didn't wait for Cap to retrieve his mount. I headed for home. I had no sooner started back when Long rose from the trail before me with his old double barrel resting across his shoulder.
Sorry I got here too late to help.
The truth was, I was glad that he was too late. I wondered how to explain to him that the best of intentions and loyalty weren't enough sometimes to overcome our rugged, bloody hearts. And that killing Billy was indeed no way to save a friend. Well, Bobby was standing in the light of the open door waiting for me, and she prepared our table for Billy's body while Long and I carried him into the house. She cried and looked to me to cry also, but I couldn't find a single tear to shed for Billy or for her either. I passed the night staring into the fireplace with Billy lying on my table, cold despite the flames that flickered over his face. Come morning, Cap made it known that he wanted an official inquest to record the shooting and to justify his actions, but he wasn't hypocrite enough to argue very long with our intentions of burying Billy that very day. He had laid low too many men without aid of judge or jury far out on the wastes. He scrawled out his account of Billy's demise on a scrap of butcher paper and asked for all our signatures to support his claims. History is as simple a thing as that, and I signed the page. There was no next of kin that we knew of, so Cap left all Billy's possessions with me to do as I pleased. I intended to bury most of Billy's things with him, or at least what I could. I would give his horse and saddle to Owen when he was old enough to ride, and his fancy spurs to Samuel when he too was of age. Billy's good Sharps rifle I kept for myself to keep well oiled and hanging on my wall. Long and I dug Billy's grave on the side of the hill above the house at a place I thought he would like, overlooking the wide sweep of the plains. The women dressed him in a good suit we found among his travel roll, and they trimmed his hair up neat. I found myself staring at his freshly polished boots, his Stetson laid upon his breast, and I was sure he would be pleased with the way they had spruced him up to look like he had always liked to look. If he was still alive, I would have told him there was no such thing as a handsome corpse. We wrapped his body with a good quilt, and in silent procession, carried him up the hill on the tailgate taken from my wagon. Bobby stood at the edge of the grave in a black dress, and I wondered if all pioneer women kept such things packed away in secret trunks, thus prepared and equipped to see good men placed beneath the ground. Our boys clung to her hands with big, solemn eyes, looking so much alike in every detail that they could easily pass for twins. They both seemed the spitting image of Billy. Maybe it was just the way the sunlight was hitting my eyes. I'd sworn off judging anything life offered, but I couldn't help but consider if the child swelling in her belly then would look like Billy too. Long after we laid Billy low and all his mourners had gone away, I sat in the grass and studied the fresh mound of earth that now separated him from all but memory. All that I held against him was buried beneath that dirt, and I knew he had drawn a tougher lot than I in the end. Maybe given time, after I'd come enough to sit and talk with him about the old days, we would be better friends than ever. Under the dying light of that setting sun, I pulled a piece of paper from my pocket and studied it like I had so many times since the morning. In my hand, I held the bill of sale for Dunny, made out my name, and signed just the day before with B. Hopkins' hand. I'd found it in Billy's breast pocket, with two buckshot holes through its middle, and his own blood staining the yellow paper brown. When I got back to the house, I would place it in the fancy little box Bobby kept on the mantel, so every now and then I might take it down and remember what very little I'd known of Billy Champion up until the bitter end. Somewhere west of Plum Creek, Texas Panhandle, 1890. The old ranger had kept his eyes upon the skyline and stopped to check his back trail more than once. He did it more out of habit than out of necessity, for the Indians were all but tamed, and most outlaws of any account had all been hanged or elected to office. But there had been a time when a cautious man lived much longer, and he preferred to exist in the bygone, way out beyond sundown, in that faded land where the bronky ones still roamed. He stopped upon the brow of a hill, and his pale blue eyes, made paler and watery by long exposure to the sun, took in the land before him. Both memory and vision tracked across that vast sweep of country, and the pioneer heart in him searched for what should be contained within that expanse. It wasn't the grass in the wind that waved before his eyes, but instead, a parade of long-ago images seared into his memory so deep that they branded him. The good horse beneath him was restless, and he could remember when he, too, was chomping at the bit to bring law and order to that last bit of wild Texas. He knew that there was bound to be a territory still left wild enough to need his kind of lawman, but he was too old to search it out, and he returned his mind to the task at hand. Buzzards were circling in the air a couple of miles to the west, and he set out with them as a beacon. He wound his way across the rolling prairie, nose to the wind and cautious hand near his gun. The lines in his leathery face showed his age, but the thought of the pursuit ahead lightened him, and he felt 20 years fall away. He had a report of a murdered man found shot upon the plains and left there by the discoverer due to a lack of transportation or a shortage of concern. It might just be your common run-of-the-mill murder, if there was such a thing. The old ranger didn't count on it, though, because life had taught him that murder has a complexity all its own. The sign at the scene of the crime would be faded and faint, but no matter. He'd been on the cold trails before, as vague and as impossible as the reasons why people committed the crimes they did. And long ago, he'd given up all speculation of personality and motivation where those he hunted were concerned. Experience had taught him that you never know what kind of man or woman you're chasing, because even the tracks left by the guilty are secondhand hearsay to the truth. He approached the body warily, cutting a wide circle, casting for sign before his horse's hooves marred the ground. The buzzards had just recently arrived, and they flushed upward only at the last minute, reluctant to give up what they too had found. He knelt beside the body and studied the twisted lay of it there in the grass and put a finger to the bloody hole and busted bone centered in the chest. Cap Arrington needed no witness to tell what his tracker's eyes told him just as plain. The dead man's rifle was just beyond his death-drawn, outstretched hand, and the bullet that killed him had taken him in the front. Cap worked the action of the rifle and found one empty case in the chamber. It was readily apparent that the killer had given his victim at least a fighting chance. While his mind absorbed the evidence, Cap walked back and forth, studying the ground between the body and where the killer had fired from. It was a long 100 yards or better to where he found the hoof prints and the spent shell that had taken Dale Martin's life.
That was a damn good offhand shot for a man sitting horseback to me.
Lots of folks had reason to want that stock detective dead. But the man who had done the deed wanted to make sure that whoever found Dale Martin's body recognized what he died for. Across his chest lay a hammerless Sharps rifle with the initials B.C. carved in the stock. Yeah, it was a hell of a thing to believe that a man 3 years dead could shoot so true from the grave. Cap wished all such crimes were so easily solved. He'd never known Nate was such a marksman, but it seemed like half of Texas had been settled by Tennesseans, and they were all shooters by the time they were big enough to hold a gun. Cap was getting too old to chase outlaws much longer, and he'd been offered a good-paying job as manager of a ranch. The new job required he run off most of a tough rustler crew and toss a certain Englishman out on his ass. That seemed to offer enough excitement and light work for an old wolf like him in his declining years. He could see no sense in cluttering the books for the next man in office by leaving such a difficult case. So he dragged the body and the evidence over to the nearest wash. Then, he caved in the bank of earth over it all to keep it from the buzzards.
Damn the buzzards. And damn the prying eyes of men with lesser senses of what constitutes fair play. Yep.
He rode away to disappear into the horizon, as all such men do. As he passed down his last long years, he recalled the men of the country gone before him to vanish along hoof-rutted trails, like Blue Knight, Billy Champion, and others too wild for a more settled land. Nobody would ever know their long years, dry years, cold years, freedom clouded in dust. The time would come when such men were as rare as dinosaur bones. The last of the old breed, come long before to orphan themselves upon the plains. Brett Cogburn's Panhandle is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2012, Brett Cogburn. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication prohibited. Performed by Mort Shelby, Tim Getman, Michael Glenn, Joe Brack, Thomas Penny, Christopher Graybill, Elizabeth Jernigan, Terrence Aselford, David Coyne, David Harris, Nick DePinto, Tim Carlin, Matthew Bassett, Ken Jackson, Dylan Lynch, Michael John Casey, Colleen Delaney, Scott McCormick, Tim Pabone, Richard Rowan, Justin Wirtz, Nanette Savard, and Margie Tomprose. Additional Boot Hill Boys and Dry Gulch Gals by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Rose Elizabeth Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Justin Wirtz and Damian Choppy Chop Richardson. Graphic audio sound design by Justin Wirtz and Thomas Hogan. Additional music by Thomas Hogan and Johann Detweiler. Panhandle theme by Thomas Hogan. book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Brett Cogburn's Panhandle, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. And be sure to listen to William W. Johnstone's The Family Jensen, Charles G. West's War Cry, and Elmer Kelton's Joe Pepper. All available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. We appreciate it.
Graphic Audio presents The Goblin Trilogy, Book 3, Goblin War.
I see you found yourself a spider.
No, not exactly. Smudge was...
You know this creature, Darnak? This was your guide?
Jake ran away when we got into the dragon's cave. Never thought to see him again.
My dwarves will march into the very halls of death, and there they will...
Die! You're serious? You're going to send mortals to face a god in his home? Every last one of your followers will die, Issa!
Death is inevitable, dear Autumn Star. You, of all beings, should know that. For Jig and Shadow Star!
Treachery! You beg for mercy in order to buy time for your army!
I didn't mean to.
And you, daughter, you help these creatures? Arrest my daughter, Darnak, as well, and kill the goblins!
Wait! If you want to fight me, do it with honor. A duel. Stabbing an unarmed prisoner is a sort of treacherous, dishonorable thing a goblin would do.
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220, or go to www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, or want the complete series now, check out our long-haul MP3 series sets, conveniently shipped to you on a USB flash drive. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.